Monday. I'm Jason Page, July 11th, 2022, the Don't Mind Me podcast. Courtesy of Believe, you can watch us live on YouTube Monday through Thursday from 11 a.m. to noon Eastern. For those of you watching, we appreciate it, whether it's live or later on in the Decibel 88 channel. Feel free to go and check us out there. Got a lot I want to get into over the next 60 minutes or so. And always on Mondays, because you're coming back from the weekend, and there's obviously a lot to sort of dig into. I'll get into baseball coming up a little later on in the podcast. The Aaron Judge conversation got a little more interesting on Sunday. Interestingly, I think the most fascinating thing to come out of the Yankees-Red Sox series after four games, wild games at Fenway Park, really had nothing to do with anything on the field. So we'll get to that coming up in a little bit. Also, I cannot figure out for the life of me why the NBA Summer League gets so much play. And maybe I should know. Maybe I actually do know and understand. I'll get into that coming up a little later on. But let me start out with Wimbledon, because we don't give tennis a lot of attention, nationally, especially in the U.S., because American tennis hasn't been very good for a while. I mean, let's be honest. On the men's side, since Pete Sampras, I mean, think about this. Since Pete Sampras left the game, is there anything worth talking about? And John Isner here and there sort of makes runs deep. Do you know what John Isner is? John Isner is the Matt Kuchar of men's tennis, American men's tennis. Matt Kuchar signs and cashes huge paychecks from the PGA Tour. He's the kind of guy I could picture going to play on LIV Golf too, by the way. Because winning majors and place in history never really mattered that much to Matt Kuchar. And just doesn't. Because he's a really good golfer and he's never been able to break through. You can even argue he's a great golfer with all the titles he's won. Yet he's never managed to win a major. And John Isner's sort of the same way. Huge serve, really good at tennis, never broke through and won a Grand Slam event. Anyway, I digress. I watched Wimbledon over the weekend, and I saw, and Rybakina wins on the women's side, and that's a whole nother topic, because Wimbledon didn't want a Russian basically competing at Wimbledon. And a Russian wound up winning on the women's side. Oh, but she says she's from Kazakhstan. Yeah, she moved there 3 years ago. She's a Russian. So what'd you really get for banning all the Russians at Wimbledon this year? What did Wimbledon get for that? A woman winning on the women's side that's a Russian. So Novak Djokovic wins Wimbledon. And it got me into thinking a little bit about the conversation of GOAT, greatest of all time. Who's the greatest of all time? With Novak Djokovic's win over Nick Kyrgios in four sets on Sunday morning, really early Sunday morning for those of us living on the West Coast, he now has 21 Grand Slams. Rafa Nadal has 22. Roger Federer has 20. And then Pete Sampras, who at one time was considered the greatest, had 14. So it got me into this. And again, you start going down into these rabbit holes. And in your mind, in your brain, trying to put into context history and who's the greatest of all time. And somebody tweeted something last night that I think makes the argument that I'm about to make, or it helps me make the argument that I'm about to make. I'll pull it up. I mean, I guess theoretically I could have put it on the screen, but that would have been too much work for the sake of the video cast. So, Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer have won 16 of the last 17 Australian Opens, 17 of the last 18 at Roland Garros, the French Open, 17 of the last 19 at Wimbledon. I think Andy Murray might have won the others. And 12 of the last 18 U.S. Opens. Think about that for a second. And then digest what I'm about to say. And before you overreact and say it's, you know, participation trophy-ish or any of that stuff, take what I'm about to say and kind of let it sit for a second. Maybe all three of them are just the greatest of all time. But you can't. It's got to be one person. You can't have multiple greatests of all time. There can only be one. It's participation trophy. Everybody gets an award. No. Let's all keep in mind who we consider the greatest whenever we have these conversations. It's always subjective. There is no one thing. Oh, well, what about, you know, how many Grand Slams they win? All right, well, Rafa Nadal went out in the semifinals of this event with a torn stomach muscle, basically. A match in which he won, by the way, with that torn stomach muscle against Taylor Fritz, which is crazy to think about all unto itself. He's got 22 slams. Federer's been stuck at 20 forever, which is still only two behind the record. But would anybody argue that when he was healthy and playing consistently and regularly, was anybody better than Roger Federer? Well, now Novak Djokovic, who I think is 36, has 21, and some might argue, well, he wasn't allowed to play the Australian Open, and he's not going to be allowed to play it next year, and he's not going to be allowed to play the U.S. Open this year unless the U.S. changes some rules. Think of how many more majors he would have won. You could put asterisks on all of these things. On all of these things. And drive yourself crazy. Or you can just sit with the idea that all three of them are, they're just the three of them are the greatest of all time. And nobody will come close. And what's wrong with that?
Well, because somebody's got to be the best.
Says who? Says why? And again, it gets into this conversation. Well, what does it mean to be the greatest? You know, Jack Nicklaus, bless his aged heart, Jack Nicklaus has the most major wins of all time in golf. And Tiger Woods has been chasing him down for, you know, the last 20 years. And Jack Nicklaus has 18 majors to his credit. Tiger Woods has 15.
Well, then Jack has to be the best.
Well, they played in different eras. Who makes one better than the other? Jack played against the likes of Arnold Palmer and Lee Trevino and Raymond Floyd and Tom Watson and all these different great golfers that were out there. But many could argue that Tiger has created a generation of golfers that are now making it difficult for him to win more majors, aside from the fact that he's obviously had a number of physical issues. But you can make the argument that, you know, Tiger's era is better than Jack's era.
Well, Jack was playing with Persimmon Woods
and different clubs and inferior technology, and he was doing what he was doing. Yes, but everybody he played with was playing in that same playing field. Tiger is playing with better equipment, but so is everybody else. So how do you make the argument? Maybe you don't. Maybe you just say they're the two greatest golfers of all time. You want to sit there and argue amongst your friends at a bar over some drinks about which one is better? Knock yourself out. But for the sake of me, and people will say, well, you're sitting on the fence. Okay, I got a padded seat. I'm comfortable. Why does somebody have to be the greatest of all time? Michael Jordan, all those rings, all those championships, all those MVPs. Is he the greatest of all time? Well, my God, Wilt Chamberlain was a dynamo, a beast, a giant in the sport. Why couldn't you argue Wilt was the greatest basketball player of all time? And you can go around in this circle forever with a whole bunch of different things. But it just gets you to wondering and thinking about the idea of who is the greatest. Who is the greatest of all time in a certain sport is certainly subjective. And it may not always necessarily be one person. Look, in some sports, maybe it is. Maybe in hockey, it is Wayne Gretzky. Maybe when you stack up all the numbers and the generations, maybe Wayne Gretzky is the greatest of all time. In baseball, maybe it's Babe Ruth. Who is Babe Ruth? I always think of, was it Claudia in White Men Can't Jump when she's on Jeopardy? He scored 100 points in a basketball game. Who is Babe Ruth? But something to think about as far as the tennis is concerned. And now this argument of GOAT, who's the greatest of all time. Something for you to sort of sink your teeth in. And Novak Djokovic isn't sure about whether or not he's going to play the U.S. Open. Not planning on getting vaccinated. And again, I said last week, now I know I'm going to sound like I'm talking out both sides of my mouth here, but I said last week that what Novak Djokovic is doing isn't hurting anybody except himself. And there's a differentiation to be made between what he's doing and what somebody like Kyrie Irving did in the NBA, which just crippled the Nets this past season because he didn't want to get vaccinated. In a team sport, it's different. You don't want to get vaccinated, you can't play, and you're going to miss all these games for your team. Now, the Nets could have opted to just have them play road games and not play at home. They decided not to do that. But in the case of Novak Djokovic, the only person he's hurting at the end of the day is himself. Literally and potentially, well, figuratively and potentially literally. He did have COVID, after all, at some point before the Australian Open, I believe. But he says he's not going to get vaccinated. So, in all likelihood, we've seen the last of Novak Djokovic until the next French Open. Which, again, is going to make it hard for him to catch the likes of Rafa Nadal, who, if he hadn't torn a stomach muscle in this Wimbledon, could have very well been the champion. He was playing that good, even though grass isn't his best surface. Let me take issue real quick before we wrap up this first segment. Let me take issue real quick with a guy that I think is great on television. I think his analysis of the game and listening to him is as good as it gets, and whose brother I'm friends with, that being Patrick McEnroe. And that's John McEnroe. And look, everybody's entitled to their opinion. Everybody has a right to their certain thing that they want to point, they want to get out. But I was disappointed at the end of the broadcast yesterday on ESPN when they started getting into the whole COVID thing and how Novak Djokovic wasn't going to be allowed to play the U.S. Open. And McEnroe basically said that Joe Biden's administration and the U.S. government is getting in the way of tennis with the current policy that guys can't come and play, can't come in from outside the country without being vaccinated. And the quote from McEnroe is, "These politicians are getting in the way too much. They did it in Australia. Let's let the guy come in and play in the U.S. In the U.S., I mean, come on, this is ridiculous." Well, it's not ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. Now, look, the way the Australian thing happened was different than what's going on in the U.S. Comparing the two is not fair. There was a lot of miscommunication and a lot of back and forth in terms of whether Djokovic would be allowed into Australia. Ultimately, he wasn't. And there's some blame to potentially go there for the Australian government and the way they handled it. The U.S. has been very clear on who's being allowed into the country and who isn't. You got to be vaccinated. He knows the rules well in advance. And he's choosing not to do something that, frankly, for his health, he should do. And you can make the argument, well, COVID's not as severe now. If you get it, it's like a cold. Nobody's, you know, or less people are dying from it. The mortality rate, blah, blah, blah. You can get into all that stuff all you want. But the government is telling you there are certain things you have to do in order to come and play here. And it's not like he's just going to play the U.S. Open and fly out of the country. He would want to play in tune-up tournaments leading up to that U.S. Open here in the U.S., which would mean he is exposed to other people and could potentially infect them if he has the virus and isn't vaccinated. So I'm sorry, but I disagree with John McEnroe here. He knows the rules. He knows the score. He's choosing not to play by the rules being set by the United States. Then you don't play. Go find something else to do for 2 weeks in September. When we come back, I got to get into Aaron Judge, the conversation about his huge potential free agency contract. Could it get solved before free agency? We'll get into that and more as we continue. I'm Jason Page. Thanks for being with us. Monday edition. Don't mind me. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to hit the like button. Make sure to subscribe to our videos. If you're listening to the podcast, courtesy of Believe, make sure to subscribe. And that way, every day when we post the podcast, you'll get it. We're coming back. Stay with us. Still to come. Thoughts about the NBA Summer League. And if you're a fan of the NBA Summer League, you're probably going to be disappointed in what I have to say. But we'll get to that coming up in just a few minutes. The Aaron Judge conversation is likely to be, and I'll agree with Buster Olney on this, who was saying it during the Sunday night baseball game on ESPN last night, that the Aaron Judge contract negotiation, not that there's really one taking place, at least as far as we know, that it's a topic that's really going to be much of what's discussed in the second half of the baseball season as we approach the All-Star break right now. You're going to hear a lot about this contract and whether or not the Yankees will wind up watching Aaron Judge walk, because once you get to free agency, anything could happen. Somebody could offer him $50 million a year. I mean, would it shock you if some owner with deep pockets whose team is on the precipice of success decides, you know what? Watch this. We're going to offer Aaron Judge $50 million. And then what do the Yankees do? They've got a plethora of guys in their farm system that are coming up that are supposed to be big stars. They've got a lot of talent. You still got Giancarlo Stanton, all these other guys. I mean, they would put the Yankees to a test if somebody said, we're going to make Aaron Judge the first $50 million man. There's guys out there making around 40. There's Max Scherzer making 43.3. But who's going to be the first $50 million man? Is it Aaron Judge? One of the interesting stories that came out of the Yankees-Red Sox series this weekend had nothing to do with anything on the field. The two teams split the four-game series. it's a better split for the Red Sox than it is the Yankees, because the Yankees won the first two games of the series. They could have certainly buried the Red Sox as it related to making any sort of run in the second half at trying to catch the Yankees in the division. Yankees had their lead up to about 16 and a half games. No blood drawn at the end of the day. The Yankees were up 14 and a half when the series started. I think they're up 14 and a half when the series ends. They split the four games. Wild games at Fenway Park. And that park just yields all sorts of weird results. It is not, I don't think it is emblematic. And Red Sox fans will come away from this series thinking that they are on, you know, they can play with the Yankees. I even heard Alex Cora saying that during the course of this year. Oh, we're good enough to play with the Yankees. Well, there's 29 teams or 30 teams in Major League Baseball that are good enough to play with, you know, the Yankees. They get to play with them on the field. Doesn't mean they really play on the same playing field as the Yankees when you look at what they've accomplished through the first half of the season. And granted, you know, they've been healthy largely outside of some bullpen health issues. They've been healthy. They've gotten some great play out of Matt Carpenter. But if you want to say this Red Sox team is on the same level as the Yankees, put them in a seven-game series, and I think you'll find out pretty quickly that they're not. Matching up your best pitcher against theirs. And I know the Red Sox are going to get some guys back. Chris Sale will be back soon enough. Hopefully after he buys a new TV for the minor league team in Worcester that he destroyed. But the biggest news to come out of this Yankees-Red Sox series, which I'll eventually pay off my tease, don't worry. The biggest news was Aaron Judge during an interview with David Cohn during the broadcast. They aired it during the broadcast. It was before the game. Essentially saying, no, we're talking. We're still hoping to talk to the Yankees and could potentially get something done before the end of the season. Now, Buster Olney came on and said, that is a pipe dream. Aaron Judge's camp at this point would rather just take him to free agency and see what kind of offer is made. But the fact that Judge went on, Aaron Judge doesn't say anything by accident. He is of the mold of Derek Jeter. Say a lot without saying anything at all. And in the instances where he does say something and make news like he did last night on the broadcast by saying, hey, Yankees, let's talk, you, me, my agent, about a deal. Nothing he says is by accident. So if Aaron Judge is saying, hey, we're still hopeful we could get something done before the end of the year, then Aaron Judge is saying, hey, Yankees, come to the table with something. And I've said this before. I think $40 million a year will get it done. He has made it clear he wants to be a Yankee. And if that's the case, if the Yankees offer him $40 million and he turns it down, then he's a liar. And he doesn't want to be a Yankee. Simple as that. If Aaron Judge wants to be a Yankee and they offer him $40 million a year, make him the highest paid position player in baseball, you have to take that deal. $40 million a year, 8 years, take you to your 38th birthday. $320 million over 8 years. Want to give him an opt-out after four? Okay. His numbers aren't likely to get better after 4 years. If anything, his numbers may decrease a little bit. But $320 million over 8 years. Get it done. I think he says yes to it. And if he doesn't again, that's not on the Yankees at that point. It means he really wants to test free agency, and it's about the money, and it's not about staying with the Yankees. But if you're the Yankees, you have to do everything you can on your end to at least give off the appearance that you did everything you could to keep Aaron Judge. Otherwise, you're going to be crucified by this fan base. And look, maybe the Steinbrenners don't care about that. Brian Cashman sure doesn't seem to care. Be interesting. Be an interesting second half. And again, what happens if Aaron Judge, you know, playing in center field dives for a ball and breaks an ankle or fractures something or breaks a thumb and misses the whole second half. Again, it's a gamble. It's risky. Playing one of the toughest positions in the sport. As a guy who's 6'7" or whatever he is. Can we also, just a couple of quick other baseball things here. Two things. One, can we get the player interview during every game? The local markets, you know, the Yes Network, Bally Sports, when they're doing some of these broadcasts for these local teams around the game. Can we get a player interview during every game? Can we just draw that into the MLB deal with the Players Association that every single game, every night for a half an inning, you get the home team announcers talking to their player? Because to me, that is must-see TV. Alex Verdugo, who I think it was, out in left field last night for the Red Sox, being interviewed. And we see it on Sunday Night Baseball all the time. It's one of my favorite things. You want to talk about ways to get people more engaged in the game, to watch the game more, to get young people excited about baseball. Make that a part of every broadcast. I'm not just talking about the national ones on Fox Sports or Peacock or Apple TV. No, just give it to me in every game. Because you never know what's going to happen while they're talking to the player. A ball could get hit off the monster. It could be a ground ball to them. They could have to run and chase something down. But it's great TV. And I know there's some risk involved as a player 100% paying attention if they're talking to the announcers. And I'm sure at some point something's going to happen in a game where this half an inning where they're talking to a player results in something. And somebody's going to say, was he distracted because he was talking to Carl Ravitch and these guys? Fine. It's a 162-game season. It's not the reason you didn't make the playoffs. Give me that in every game. That's one thing. The other, how about the two most unlikely winning streaks in Major League Baseball this year? If before the season started, you had the Orioles and Mariners both at the same time on 7 or 8-game winning streaks, whatever the hell it is right now, if you had that, you're a liar. You're a bold-faced liar. You didn't have it. Show me it on a betting slip or something. I don't believe it. There isn't anybody that could have predicted the Orioles would be making this kind of run. Now, I think just a game under 500. I think they're 43-44. And the Mariners are becoming hunters in the AL West, and as far as the wild card is concerned. It's going to be tough to catch the Astros. I mean, the Astros and the Yankees are very similar in that they've both got off to such good starts that they're going to be very difficult to catch by anybody. I mean, they would really have to go into the tank. But the Orioles, man, they just keep finding ways to win, and man, are the Angels bad. Whew! Angels are tough to watch right now. Unless Shohei Ohtani's pitching, they can't win anything. But the Mariners, that's the fun team to watch for the next decade. For the rest of this decade, give me the Mariners. Carlos Santana putting up some ding-dongs yesterday, and the Mariners win. So, two most unlikely winning streaks in baseball this year. At the same time, the Orioles and the Mariners. Last thing on baseball, and then I'll get to the NBA stuff. I can't figure out for the life of me. You know, and again, it gets into this conversation, these things of subjectivity. Let me give you something. The 2002 Major League Baseball All-Star Game. Let me tell you who the catchers were for the 2002 Major League Baseball All-Star Game. For the American League, the starter was Jorge Posada. Borderline Hall of Famer. And Mike Piazza, a guy who is a Hall of Famer. Also, A.J. Pierzynski was on that team. A solid all-around catcher for a long time. Benito Santiago and Damian Miller were also on the team. Damian Miller, eh. But Benito Santiago was not a perennial All-Star, but he had 5 appearances in the All-Star game. Now, let me give you just a compare and contrast. All-Stars this year for catchers in the sport of baseball. Travis d'Arnaud is the reserve. Wilson Contreras is the starter for the Cubs. And for the American League, Alejandro Kirk, who's an outstanding hitter, makes the All-Star game. And look, I think the Jose Trevino story is one of the best stories in baseball this year. I mean, the Yankees got a couple of them. They've got Nestor Cortez, who also made the All-Star game, by the way. They've got the story of Matt Carpenter, which is crazy. The guy was left for dead by most of baseball. They were telling the story on Sunday Night Baseball last night of how him and his camp sent out 20 emails to different teams to try and get them to sign him and sent him like a flashy video of, hey, look, Matt Carpenter's back. And only one team responded, and it was the Yankees. Yeah. But the Yankees catcher, Jose Trevino, has made the All-Star team. Let me give you Jose Trevino's numbers. He made it as a reserve. 261, 7 home runs, 27 RBIs. He's got 41 hits and 157 at-bats. Again, he's had a bunch of clutch hits for the Yankees. It's great. But you're telling me that's the second best catcher in the American League? You're telling me you couldn't get anybody better than Jose Trevino? Says a lot about where catching has gone in the American League or in baseball. And again, I love the story. Journeyman making basically the league minimum. How is he an all-star? How is the guy an all-star? I mean, it's really nuts. But there you go. Jose Trevino. All-star Jose Trevino. I do have to say, the video of Aaron Boone telling Jose Trevino he made the all-star team along with some of the other Yankee reserves is very cool. If you get a chance, go online and check it out. Okay, the NBA Summer League. Why am I talking about it? I may ask myself that same question as we continue. Don't mind me. I'm Jason Page with you on this Monday, July 11th, 2022. Stay with us. All right, good to be with you on this Monday, July 11th. The Don't Mind Me podcast, courtesy of Believe. Also, you can watch the show on YouTube live Monday through Thursday from 11 a.m. to noon Eastern. Hopefully we got some cool things we're going to be announcing in the days ahead as it relates to our Decibel 88 channel and some things we're going to be doing. So before we say goodbye, a thought on the NBA Summer League, which I don't think I've ever talked about in any way, shape, or form on any broadcast that I've ever done in my life. Because I don't know when it became such a big thing. And maybe to sort of dovetail off what we were just talking about with Major League Baseball and watchability and getting the young kids excited, maybe this is a product of the fact that baseball is just so unappealing to so many people that they actually talk about the NBA Summer League. That's one theory that I'll throw out there. That maybe there's just nothing to watch during the summer that people will watch, you know, 20-year-olds and 19-year-olds and 21-year-olds and second-year NBA players playing against each other in glorified scrimmages that aren't really indicative or determinative of anything. Now, maybe it's a product of the fact that it's carried on ESPN. And as we know, ESPN loves to pump up the base on anything that is aired on ESPN. Again, they barely paid attention to hockey for, whatever, 15 years when it wasn't on ESPN. Then as soon as it comes back, well, now we get hockey all the time. Hockey, hockey, hockey. But the NBA Summer League? Really? Glorified exhibitions?
Well, you know, the best rookies and look, the top draft pick and Chet Holmgren and watch all these young stars running around playing against each other. It's so exciting. Look at this buzzer beater and this great comeback, and it means nothing.
Not a single thing. I have never once, ever, and look, ESPN and others are treating it like it's must-watch TV. I have never once in a summer, in all the time that the NBA Summer League's been getting run on ESPN or NBA TV or any of these things, said,
well, I gotta watch that Summer League game because so-and-so is playing against so-and-so.
It's not even the real head coaches. They're the assistants who are running these teams, which in the case of Becky Hammon when it was the Spurs was kind of cool. But I can't for the life of me figure out why anybody is talking about
the Warriors' wild comeback win over the Spurs in the Summer League.
Oy vey. Could you give me a break? And again, maybe it's an indictment on baseball. I'll give you one more on this. Did you see the rings that the NBA Summer League champions get? The NBA Summer League champions get these championship rings. And again, I'm looking at these things going, really? You get this for playing in the Summer League? It's like going to summer camp.
You get a ring.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's crazy. And compare that ring, by the way, that the Summer League champions get. Do they have confetti come down from the ceiling? But you get these rings. Did you see the trophy that Kelsey Plum, who if you don't know who she is, she plays in the WNBA. She won the All-Star Game MVP honors for the WNBA yesterday. And the trophy that she got for winning the All-Star Game MVP honors, it might as well have been the participatory trophy that you see given out at, you know, Little League games. It was so weak and pathetic. I mean, it's tiny. Again, go Google it. Kelsey Plum, her All-Star Game MVP trophy. This tiny little trophy. Best story to come out of WNBA All-Star Game weekend. Best story to come out of WNBA All-Star Game weekend. You know what it was? League commissioner saying, we're going to 40 games next year. That will be the most the WNBA has played. Who knows? Maybe players will make enough money that they don't have to go play overseas in places like, say, Russia and potentially get set up by the government and arrested and locked up for multiple years or held hostage in some political standoff with the United States. Just an idea. Maybe we'll pay them enough that they don't have to go and play in Zimbabwe during the WNBA offseason. Maybe. Just an idea. Maybe we can keep all the girls stateside. Again, just an idea. Hey, we made it through the whole show without talking about any golf today. Just kidding. I did talk about it a little in the first segment. Congratulations to Jack Nicklaus, by the way. He's going to be an honorary citizen of St. Andrews, where they're playing the Open Championship this week. I'm telling you, throw some shekels down on Tiger Woods. He knows that course like the back of his hand. Maybe a 16th major for Tiger in the offing. We'll talk about that as we get deeper into the week. We'll look at the odds tomorrow. Congratulations, Tony Romo, by the way. Won his third American Century celebrity title, that celebrity golf tournament they play every year. Reno, Tahoe area. It's going to do it for me. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to like us on YouTube. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, the Decibel 88 channel. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, courtesy of Believe, you can do it on every major podcasting platform. That's it for Monday. Don't mind me. I'm Jason Page. Catch you on Tuesday.